continues, it's going to be a threat in regard to international affairs.
And on that note, I thank both of you being with me on the spotlight. Out of Johannesburg, Thembisa Fuku, the Senior Research Fellow and Director of Africa-Asia Dialogues, and Abayomi Azikiwe, Editor, Pan-African Newswire, out of Detroit. Thank you both. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another spotlight right here at Press TV. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing out for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Next, you will hear recitation of verse 21. Of chapter Ibrahim from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Reza Young.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم وبرزوا لله جميعا فقال ضعفاء للذين استكبروا إنا كنا لكم تبعا فهل أنتم مغنون عنا من عذاب الله من شيء قالوا
سَوَاءٌ عَلَيْنَا أَجَزِعْنَا
أطعنا أم صبرنا سواء علينا أجزعنا أم صبرنا ما لنا من محيص صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful. And they shall all come forth before Allah. Then the weak shall say to those who were proud, "Surely we were your followers. Can you therefore avert from us any part of the chastisement of Allah?" They would say, "If Allah had guided us, we too would have guided you. It is the same to us whether we are impatient now or patient. There is no place for us to fly to."
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
A crush at a charity distribution center in the Yemeni capital Sana'a leaves more than 80 people dead and hundreds more injured. French President Emmanuel Macron is loudly booed by crowds in his first trip out of Paris after signing his unpopular pension reform into law. And the family of an African-American killed by the U.S. police in Memphis files a $500 million lawsuit against the city and police department. Our top story for this half hour, more than 80 people have been killed and hundreds more injured in a stampede in the Yemeni capital, Sana'a. Women and children are among the dead, over a dozen of some 300 injured are in critical condition. The stampede took place during the distribution of charitable donations. On the final days of the holy month of Ramadan, hundreds of people had crowded into a school to receive cash handouts. Yemen's Interior Ministry said that the organizers of the event have been detained and are being questioned. The impoverished nation Yemen is embroiled in an 8-year war launched by a Saudi-led coalition. Tens of thousands of people have been killed due to war. Drought and blockade on the country have also pushed millions into hunger. French President Emmanuel Macron has been loudly booed by crowds in eastern France. This came after he embarked on his first trip out of Paris since signing his unpopular pension reform into law.
Yes, I shouted and said that we'll fight to be able to retire at 60 and that the French, like all French people, will continue to show our discontent.
I didn't come to see him specifically. In fact, I wanted to make sure that he would see that we would be present at every one of his trips. We're not going to turn the page on pension reform. It's been 3-4 years that every time he takes a stand or whatever, it's worse. He annoys people.
As Macron arrived in Sélestat in the Alsace region, locals chanted slogans calling on him to resign while booing and jeering him. As well, a local man said Macron's government was corrupt on a scale never seen before, telling the president he will fall soon. On an earlier stage of his trip, the French police pushed back dozens of protesters banging kitchenware ahead of Macron's arrival in a village. Macron, however, seemed undeterred, telling reporters that such incidents would not stop him from making visits across France and going on walkabouts. Macron signed into law the controversial pension reform on Saturday, which increases retirement age from 62 to 64. Food prices in Europe continue to soar, and in France they've risen almost three times the overall rate of inflation. The government has just responded with a limited number of price caps, but many fear that corporations and retailers will simply raise prices on other key goods. Rami Mazzotti has more from Paris.
At a rate of 6%, inflation in France is still at its worst since the 1980s. However, new data shows that all-important food prices continue to push to unseen levels, having leapt a whopping 16% since last year.
I'm a shopkeeper, but I also grow wheat and raise cattle. So I can tell you that those who are raising their prices the most are the big corporations. The small producers suffered and tried for a long time not to raise their prices. But now everyone is raising their prices. For example, chicken is up 30% this year.
From April through June, there will be price caps on certain goods, following last month's acceptance by major retailers and middlemen of a government initiative. It's expected to cost them hundreds of millions of euros. However, many say they can afford it. Ever-increasing corporate profits have been the norm across Europe since 2009. And in the post-COVID world, many analysts say that corporate price gouging, government-approved speculation, and stockholder profit hoarding are the hidden driver of Europe's high prices.
Il faut prendre des mesures autoritaires.
We must take authoritarian measures. There's simply no other way. We must implement price controls, the indexing of wages to prices, and much more. But a government must have the will to do such things. And that takes us back to the necessity of choosing an alternative political path than our current model.
Polls show that 96% of France agrees with the statement that some suppliers are opportunistically taking advantage of inflation. Opportunism aside, the soaring prices are the enduring result of the West's failed sanctions campaign against Russia over the long-term unrest in the Ukraine. Instead of sowing peace and reaping low prices, the European Union is finding that belligerence backfires, and especially for the average person. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
A housing crisis is crippling the lives of renters in the UK as high demand and a staggering decline in available properties have resulted in tenants across the country facing a dramatic increase in the price of rent. Saeed Puruza looks into how things got here.
Britain is facing a renting crisis. A combination of soaring demand and a shrinking market has sent rents through the roof.
More than 3.5 million people in England alone have seen their rent rise to unaffordable amounts over the past year. And according to one property site, a single person spends more than a third of their income on rent. And that's before council tax and energy bills.
The price of a month's worth of rent in the British capital has soared by an average of more than 16% over the past year, with the average rent price reaching a record $2,910 a month, the highest in the country. In other big cities, such as in Manchester, it's gone up to more than 20%, and in Birmingham, more than 17%. Alex, who asked not to be identified, shared a house in West London with his partner and another couple for 2 years, but had to move when the rent skyrocketed.
The contract that we originally had was 3 years with a two-year break clause. Our original contract state being £2,800 a month, but we had an email from our landlord stating that it's going to be increased to 4,000, which I think is a little over 40%.
Property experts say higher mortgage interest rates and taxation are forcing landlords to either increase the rent or withdraw their properties from the market,
sending renters fighting over available properties.
It's really not a good time for tenants and renters in general. We've seen that any one property will have multiple offers. Just recently, we did a viewing on a flat, a two-bedroom flat in Ruislip, West London, where we did 14 viewings and we have 14 offers.
But what is the reason behind the increase in demand? A housing deficit is one reason. Britain has a backlog of 4.3 million homes that are missing from the national housing market, as they were never built. Another is a rise in net migration.
So now that's because of Ukraine, refugees coming in from there. It's also because of the situation with Hong Kong and because of the increases in the numbers of international students coming into the UK as well. Now, with these groups of people, they tend to move into places like London or big cities like Birmingham or Manchester.
Calls for a rent freeze are growing, but that is yet to happen. And pressures on the rental market are not expected to ease anytime soon. Saeed Pariza, London.
Protests have erupted in the U.S. city of Akron, Ohio, after a grand jury refused to indict police officers involved in last year's shooting death of an African-American man. Videos circulating online show security forces use chemical sprays and other weapons to disperse the crowd. Police tried to break up the protest, calling it an unlawful assembly. Demonstrators are angry at a grand jury decision not to press charges against officers who, according to them, mistakenly shot Jaylen Walker 46 times last June. Walker's family now says they will file a civil lawsuit against the city in the upcoming months. That's the same path the family of Tyree Nichols, who was killed by U.S. police earlier this year, has decided to take.
Today, we announce a $500 million landmark lawsuit against the Memphis Police Department and the city of Memphis for the torture, savage, brutal, dehumanizing, extrajudicial killing of Tyree Nichols.
Nichols' attorney also said that the lawsuit is meant to send a message to other cities that brutalizing and terrorizing black people will be wrenchingly expensive. Nichols was beaten to death by five officers in January after he was stopped for a traffic violation. The police killing of African Americans has been a hot-button issue for a few years now. Such incidents usually draw mass protests across the country, with people calling for an end to decades of systematic racism. Several EU legislators warned provoking China at the behest of the United States would prove economically disastrous for the 27 nation bloc citizens. Relations between the EU and China have deteriorated since the beginning of the war in Ukraine. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
It is clear that greater cooperation between China and friendly nations is making many Western leaders nervous. Analysts say U.S. dominance is being eroded and a new world order is taking shape. The subject of EU-China relations has just been debated in the European Parliament.
The Chinese Communist Party's actions have now caught up with its stated ambitions and the hardening of China's overall strategic posture over the last years.
A clear majority in the European Parliament claim Moscow and Beijing have malign ambitions.
Russia and China have the same goal, to destroy the development of the democratic world, because democracy is a threat to both regimes.
There are those, however, who warn against provoking China.
First, you led us into conflict with Russia because it's in the interests of the USA. You forced us to buy more expensive gas from the United States. Now you are pushing us into confrontation with China because the US sees China as a threat to its world dominance.
Western leaders always turn to sanctions when they disagree with a foreign government, but they are personally insulated from the impact. Experts point out.
They are well paid. Do they feel the blowback of the sanctions? Do they know what is going on in the shops? Do they know that people like you and me are constantly overcharged with all kinds of goods?
A number of lawmakers are urging EU leaders not to follow the US down a destructive path.
U.S. financial capital wants to make profits in China and in Europe. And driving a wedge between the EU and China is a good way of going about it for them.
Trade between the EU and China is currently valued at 2.3 billion euro per day. According to many economists, ordinary EU citizens will pay a huge price if the 27-country bloc falls into line with the anti-China agenda that is being developed and promoted by the United States. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
According to Taiwanese media, the U.S. has significantly increased its military presence on the island despite China's warning by sending over 200 troops to Taiwan. This at a time of high tensions between China and the U.S. Beijing considers Taiwan as part of its territory and is against any military and diplomatic ties between the self-ruled island and any other country, especially the U.S. China views this as interference in its sovereignty.
The Taiwanese media reported about 200 American troops are now stationed across the island. The report cited sources who said U.S. Indo-Pacific Command deployed more than 200 personnel to Taiwan to assist the island's armed forces with training. When asked to confirm the deployment, the Pentagon declined to comment but affirmed its support for Taipei.
We don't have a comment on the specific operations, engagements, or training. But I would highlight that our support for and defense relationship with Taiwan remains aligned against the current threat posed by the People's Republic of China. Our commitment to Taiwan is rock solid and contributes to the maintenance of peace and stability across the Taiwan Strait and within the region.
The Wall Street Journal first reported in February that the U.S. planned to deploy between 100 and 200 troops to Taiwan. Among the more than 200 instructors, 80% are from the U.S. Army. Most of the American instructors are stationed at new training centers and reserve brigades of Taiwan's army. Since Washington severed diplomatic relations with Taipei in 1979, the U.S. still deployed a handful of military trainers to Taiwan. The small U.S. military presence in Taiwan was always an open secret, but was never officially confirmed until 2021, when President Tsai Ing-wen became the first Taiwanese leader to acknowledge U.S. troops were on the island since 1979. The increase in U.S. troops in Taiwan risks provoking a response from China, as Beijing has been strongly warning against growing U.S.-Taiwan ties. China's People's Liberation Army recently conducted major live-fire exercises around Taiwan. That was after U.S. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy hosted Taiwanese President Tsai Ing-wen in California. Beijing is opposed to Taiwan's growing nexus with the U.S. because it considers Taiwan as part of its territory under One China principle.
Taiwan is reportedly planning to buy hundreds of U.S. anti-ship missiles aimed at countering China's tensions between Beijing and the self-ruled island remain high. The report comes days after U.S. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy met with Taiwanese President Tsai Ing-wen in California and stressed the need to accelerate arms deliveries to the self-ruled island.
Taiwan is reportedly in the process of buying hundreds of land-launched Harpoon anti-ship missiles from the U.S. Citing U.S.-Taiwan Business Council President Rupert Hammond Chambers and sources, Bloomberg News reported on Monday that Taiwan was poised to purchase 400 missiles under the $1.17 billion contract announced by the Pentagon on April 7th. At the time, the Pentagon said production was expected to complete by March 2029. Commenting on the news report, Taiwanese Defense Ministry announced it had previously disclosed information about the purchase, adding it was confident the deal would go according to schedule. In 2020, Taipei said it planned to obtain land-based Boeing-made Harpoon anti-ship missiles as part of its military modernization efforts. According to the report, Taiwan previously purchased the ship-launched version of Harpoon missiles, but the new contract marks the first time it will get the mobile land-based variant. The contract with Boeing was reportedly issued by the U.S. Naval Air Systems Command on Taiwan's behalf. In reaction to the report, China's foreign ministry said it firmly opposes U.S. arms sales to Taiwan.
U.S.-Taiwan military ties and U.S. arms sales to Taiwan seriously violate the One China Principle and the three China-U.S. joint communiques, seriously damage China's sovereignty and security interests, and seriously threaten peace and stability across the Taiwan Strait. China is strongly dissatisfied and firmly opposes this.
Beijing views Taiwan as an inseparable part of China, repeatedly warning Washington against unwise provocations in this regard. China has previously warned Washington that providing the self-ruled island with advanced weaponry would breach Chinese sovereignty and do severe damage to bilateral relations.
That's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
والذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد موسیقی خاصی دارد روش خاصی دارد اینها چیزایی لازم نیست
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن. از قرآن.
Muslims major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran. Quran.
کتاب الله
Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes.
Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Month. In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, Salam and welcome to another episode of this series. The end time is the period of seditions and catastrophes. Wicked forces have employed all their power to spread their dominance in the world and stabilize it everywhere. Satan and its agents are doing their best to drag more and more people into sin and transgression. This is while there is no prophet or infallible imam to show the right path and show the true aspect of everything. That's why we read in the last part of Dua Iftitah, which has been recommended by Imam Mahdi for the nights of Ramadan. O Allah, indeed we complain to you the loss of our Prophet, our blessings upon him and his progeny, and the absence of our Master. Whoever does not see his leader and cannot communicate with him will naturally be distraught and dismal. He will complain to God as the Prophet has passed away and the last infallible Imam is in occultation too. However, this complaint does not mean protesting, but it means taking refuge and entreating for mercy and favor in the middle of oppression and corruption dominating everywhere. There are many narrations on the seditions and tough conditions of the end time and how hard it is to keep one's faith. Imam Ali, peace upon him, says, I give you one example. A man has some wheat. He dusts it and cleans it from bitter and black seeds and saves it in a store. After a while, he notices that part of the wheat has been infected with pest. He cleans the pest and again saves the remaining wheat. He does it several times so that there remain hard seeds which are not affected by pest. In the end time too, people of feeble faith will be separated from those who stay firmly in their faith and religion and practicing it, and seditions will not harm them. The 15th infallible successor of the Prophet, Imam Muhammad Baqir, peace upon him, was asked when Imam Mahdi will appear and rise up. He answered, "When false testimonies are accepted, just witnesses are rejected, and people trivialize bloodshed, adultery, and usury." It seems that we live in an era in which many of these vices have materialized. This has made it very difficult to keep faith and religion. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, said, "Keeping religion in the end time is like holding fire or pressing a thorny bush in the hand." That is why we continue in the supplication, "O Allah, we complain, the big number of our enemies and the small number of us, and the intensity of seditions against us, and the conditions of the time which are opposed to us." The Prophet has also said, "Gabriel came to me and said, 'O Messenger of Allah, soon there will be sedition among your ummah.' I asked, 'How will be the exit from it?' He said, 'The news of the predecessors and the posteriors, and the edict of what happens between you has been mentioned. Allah's book is the divider of truth and falsehood, and it is not a jest. Any oppressor who does not practice it, Allah will annihilate him, and anyone who seeks guidance in other than that, Allah will mislead him. Allah's firm cord is the wise word and the right path." The only way of salvation from the misleading conditions of the end time is to cling to the two weighty things which the Prophet left behind, the Noble Quran and his Ahlul Bayt. They will never separate from each other till they arrive at the pond of Kauthar on the day of resurrection. Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, says, "When Arqa'im rises up, it is obligatory on all to help each other. For sure, what is seen at the time of the universal movement of Imam Mahdi is friendship and cooperation. This goes to the extent that anyone who needs something can take it from his brother's pocket. But it is very important to keep oneself safe against polytheism and hypocrisy. That's why it has been stressed in Iftitah supplication to go through hardships and calamities in a way that we set the ground for the reappearance of Imam Mahdi." So we read, "And bless Muhammad and his progeny, and help us with a victory that you have expedited, and a harm that you have removed, and an assistance that you have made it mighty, and a dominance of truth that you have shown clearly, and a mercy from you that glorifies us, and a health from you that clothes us with your mercy, O most merciful of the merciful."
Thank you. Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Lost in history. Memories are sweet and heartwarming, but they also bring along the regrets of loss. People usually visit relics to alleviate this feeling. They visit the old neighborhoods, people, and houses that are full of memories. But reviewing the past torments my family, my compatriots, and me, not only can we not go back in time, but we can't go back to where our past was formed. All that is left for us are movies that open our old wounds. Our house was lost in history, and right in front of people's eyes. I am Edward Said. I was born in 1935 into a Christian family in this house. My father was a successful merchant who imported stationery from Egypt.
Not only the eldest, but he was also the only boy in the family. So I think we thought of him, his sisters, a bit as he was getting a good deal, as they say.
I was 10 or 11 years old when I little by little realized the presence of Jewish immigrants in the city. Our city was experiencing a chaotic situation in those days. Our house was not far from King David Hotel, so I was terrified when that King David Hotel bombing happened.
Jewish terrorists bombed the King David Hotel in 1946. The wreckage could be seen from our house. I recall the rising sense of danger, British soldiers on the alert, and news of impending war between Palestinians and Jewish forces.
A year later, we went to Cairo with all our relatives and family members because the situation became too difficult. That was a one-way trip with no return date.
Most of my family left Jerusalem because they had to. Our house was in an area that was totally unprotected, and it was in an area that fell to the Haganah in, I think, February of 1948. There was, to my recollection, there was no militia. There was no organized resistance of any sort. By the time the fighting began in the latter part of 1947, it became impossible to live there. And there was a general sense of panic. And my family left at the end of December of 47.
In Cairo, my father sent me to an English language school, and I found my interests in literature. My father was a wealthy man with aristocratic morals. He was proud of his U.S. passport and asked everyone to call him William. He was very organized and cared so much about discipline.
In relation to me, he was very severe. I had four sisters. He was much more partial to my sisters. And for him, I was constantly to be reformed. And in many ways, he focused on certain parts of my body. For example, my back. He was very upset at the fact that I didn't have a military posture. So there was a lot of my childhood was devoted to training my back, training it, he would say, and so on and so forth. So there was a lot of that. There was always my mother, who, of course, counterbalanced it, you know, and she tried to spoil me.
My mother was a gentle and kind woman. She took me to the best music teachers' classes of that time, and she motivated me to learn about music.
All of the things that matter to me today, music, literature, ideas really, are I owe to my mother.
I was old enough to go to university, and I studied medicine for a few years, but I did not like my field of study. For this reason, I was expelled from Victoria College in Cairo in 1962. My father was disappointed with me and sent me to the United States to study. It was the same decision that my grandfather took for my father in Bulgarian-Ottoman Wars period to keep his son out of it.
My father sent him because in those days, American law, we were American citizens, American law was such that if he didn't go by a certain age, he would lose his citizenship. So my father wanted to make sure that he kept his citizenship.
I happened to be a student at the American University at the time, from 60 onward, where Edward's sister was a classmate of mine. So I got to know the family, I got to know her, and then...
In the U.S., I chose what I was interested in and studied English literature. I was really interested in literature and made a lot of effort. Finally, I got my PhD from Harvard University. I wrote my doctoral dissertation on Joseph Conrad.
About 20 or 21, I'd read literally everything he'd ever written. And then, of course, I knew that he wasn't English and he was an outsider. And I didn't make any association with myself, although obviously he was answering to some very deep affinity that I felt with him.
Like me, Joseph Conrad was originally from another country and was born in Poland. He traveled to many countries and finally came to the U.S. and wrote his famous novels in English, just like me. I had a good life in the U.S. and everything seems to be in order until the event of 1967 that came as a great shock to me and completely changed the course of my life. Israel attacked the Egyptian army in the Sinai Peninsula. So six Arab states went to war with Israel. The war lasted only 6 days and resulted in the tripling of Israeli territories.
And that was important for understanding this shift in attitudes towards Israel and Zionism, because as the U.S. faced defeat in Southeast Asia, the victory that Israel represented in defeating the Arab states in 1967 was this seen as this incredibly positive sign of the West recovering its sense of purpose and its military prowess and so on.
And I first met him, he was just an American professor, but his connection with the Palestinian movement was after 67.
And then when the war broke out in 1967, I was desolated. I was in New York at the time, and I was completely shattered. The world as I understood it and knew it had completely ended at that moment. And it was shortly thereafter that I began for the first time, I had been in America already for 15 or 16 years, and I began for the first time to be in touch with other Arabs.
I think between 67 and the 1973 war, when Israel expanded again, he became increasingly concerned with the question of Palestine and the situation of Palestinians and of the Arab world in general.
By 1970, I was completely involved. I had started to write in this country, and I was immediately politically involved up to my neck.
Edward also, at that time, began to realize that he is damn Palestinian. And it's okay to stand up for the downtrodden, to actually regain that identity. It was in that environment that I think.
Because I discovered then that I had to rethink my my life and my identity, even though it had been so sort of sheltered and built up in this completely artificial way. I had to rethink it from the start.
we did exactly what you expect us to do. We were just modern. We talked your language. We studied your language. And then all of a sudden, this society here slapped them. They said, no, you are dirty Arabs because you couldn't even war. You couldn't even fight. The whole war lasted only 6 days. That kind of immediate collapse of the Arab armies at that time had a very, very deep influence on those, and they felt insulted.
Now, after a few years of a seemingly successful life in the United States and teaching at one of America's best universities, I felt like nothing more than a fugitive. Nothing was the same as before.
He said that directly. I'll never be home. When someone like Edouard Said says, I'll never be home, that's something strange. But if you think like a Palestinian, you'll understand.
The idea of being a fugitive is just like being affected by leprosy. You feel alone in the middle of the crowd. A fugitive can never be expelled from his homeland and can never return to it. A fugitive feels like a parasite. A fugitive is an uninvited guest who has got nothing in common with his place of residence and is always considered a stranger. All Palestinians feel the same sense of exile. Yasser Arafat, before the United Nations General Assembly on November the 13th, 1974.
I met him for a long period of time when he came to the United Nations here in November of 1974. And he had the speech that was cobbled together, and I was asked by him to put it into English, which he gave at the General Assembly. And then from then on, I started to see him regularly.
After this famous speech, the Palestine Liberation Organization was granted observer status at the UN, and the Palestinians were given the right to determine the fate of their inhabited territories. However, this situation did not last long. I became a member of Palestinian National Council for the first time 3 years before this speech. Palestinian Immigrants and Deportees Parliament. I felt like I had found my homeland again, and I had to fight to reach it.
What do you think of when you think of an Arab? Somebody with a towel on their head. Camel and maybe some sand. Want to throw a pyramid in there? Well, guess who's here? Right on our stage. This itself would not have been possible not long ago. Edward Said joins us, professor of English, Columbia University, member of the Palestine National Council, to which umbrella organization belongs, the PLO.
I spoke loudly about the reality of the Palestinian problems, and I even had to speak in front of pro-Israel Jews.
I think the main point is, if you want to negotiate some kind of peace with justice, you cannot legislate in advance who's going to represent whom. The Israeli position and the position of the ADL is that we are not only entitled to decide what to talk about, but we're going to decide who to talk to. Now, the Palestinians have their own representatives, and nobody has found any other representatives for the Palestinians except the PLO. After all, it was the Israeli government, that dispossessed the Palestinians, that destroyed Lebanon in 1982, killed...
The Israeli government...
Try as he or she might, a Palestinian finds it very difficult. I won't say impossible, but I think it's very, very hard. And I think most Palestinians are like most people. It's very hard for the Palestinian who feels himself or herself to have been the victim of injustice by Jews, Israeli Jews, to sympathize or imaginatively incorporate the history of the Holocaust and say, well, we forgive them for what they did. I mean, after all, they suffered this enormous, this colossal historical tragedy, the Jews did. And the fact that they are evicting us from our territory, that they are placing us under occupation, that they're treating us as third-class citizens, that they are killing our people, that they are confining us to camps, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, we understand. Nobody can understand that. I mean, you can grasp the first fact, the fact of the Holocaust, but you can't translate that into your own doom.
My mind has always been busy with this question. What is the reason behind the occupation of Palestine and the Western support for the occupier? In my opinion, this issue is rooted in the way the West looks at the East, and the Palestinian cause emerges in this point of view.
This war between peoples, a war which has been fought for generations, and which concerns the whole world, is, I believe, inextricably entangled with the fantasies, dreams, and ambitions of the West to rule and possess the East.
There's also a question of how Zionism conceives Arabs, and it has become current for Arabs to call Zionism a racist ideology. Now, what, Patrick Seal, is the basis of that charge?
Well, I know it's a charge which created outrage when it was first raised. I think at the UN they tried to dub Zionism as a racist thing. But you see, unfortunately, I think there is something in it. I mean, much as one hates to say so, but if you just look at some of the statements, say, of a man like Begin, I mean, he's always ranting about Jewish blood and how precious it is, with the implication, of course, that Arab blood is much less precious. And he says things like, Palestinians are animals walking on two paws. Or you remember his chief of staff at the time, Raful Eitan, talked about Palestinians being cockroaches in a bottle.
It is the default option of Europeans that the perfect and normal man is the same European man who has existed since ancient Greece. In the subconscious of a Western white man, an Eastern man is not considered an equal to a Western man in terms of humanity.
He talks about blood libel against the Jews, or of course his famous phrase at the time of the Sabra and Shatila massacre. He said, if Goyim kill Goyim, what concern is it of ours? Now that, it seems to me, is an absolutely racial remark.
In another way, I'd like to reformulate and say that had there been in the United States, for example, immigration laws which said that only white Anglo-Saxon Protestants can emigrate and get a citizenship, then you as a Jew and I as a Palestinian would object. Now, the same law, in an inverse formulation of the same law, which says that only a Jew can emigrate to Israel, whereas a Palestinian who is born there and can...
So for him, the writing of Orientalism was actually shaped by his engagement with the question of Palestine.
My years of research in literary and historical texts led me to the theory that I presented in Orientalism.
In the limelight. In Britain, the leader of the Royal College of Nursing has said nurses could go on strike until Christmas. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Sky News has covered this story and tells us more. Nurses could strike until Christmas, the leader of the Royal College of Nursing has said. Pat Cullen has also described the offer of a lump sum bonus for the last financial year as a bribe. The Royal College of Nursing announced on Friday, 14th of April, that its members will walk out for 48 hours from 8 p.m. on 30th of April after rejecting the government's 5% pay offer for the current financial year. There will be no exemptions, meaning that intensive care units and cancer care will also be affected. But Pat Cullen said nurses will leave picket lines to deal with emergencies. When asked if the union will stop the strike action, Ms. Cullen told the BBC's Laura Nussenberg on Sunday programme, "No, our nurses will absolutely not do that. We have strike action for the end of this month and the beginning of May. Then we will move immediately to ballot our members. If the ballot is successful, it will mean that further strike action right up until Christmas." Meanwhile, the chief executive of the National Health Service Confederation has said his organization is concerned about the lack of derogations or exemptions in the forthcoming strike called by the Royal College of Nursing for the end of April and the start of May. Emergency department, intensive care units, cancer care and other services that were previously exempt will be affected this time round. Matthew Taylor told Sky News he was also concerned about speculation over junior doctors striking alongside the nurses. He said, "Both of these things would be a significant escalation, and it's very difficult to see how either of those things wouldn't endanger patients' safety and dignity." He also said that the lack of derogations means we are in uncharted territory. Matthew Taylor added, "It means that the people that I represent will have to spend a great deal of time doing the detail, planning the detailed negotiation with trade unions locally to try to ensure that we can protect life and limb. So none of this is welcome." He said, however, that his organization had sympathy with doctors and nurses and was pressing the government for a proper workforce plan. Matthew Taylor, the chief executive of the NHS Confederation, said he was in a hospital last week during the junior doctor strike, and surgeons were aware that every day more people were being added to their lists because of cancelled outpatient appointments and cancelled operations. And that harm, that kind of harm, that comes from a cancelled operation, a cancelled appointment, it may not be immediately life-threatening, but it can still have a huge impact on the patient. He also urged the Royal College of Nursing to pause until the Unite and GMB unions had announced their decisions on the 5% government pay offer. "We would encourage the nurses to wait until we have the collective view of the NHS trade unions before deciding what to do next," he said. British newspaper The Guardian has also covered this story. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak appears set on trying to face down unions in a high-risk strategy to tough out a renewed wave of NHS strikes in England that health service leaders warned were unsustainable and could put patient safety in danger. With the Prime Minister and his Health Secretary Steve Barclay seemingly offering no fresh concessions for nurses or junior doctors, they risk the possibility of combined strike action, a scenario one NHS leader said would put the health service into uncharted territory. The British Medical Association, the BMA, which represents the doctors, has so far only ruled out combined action for the next nurses' strike, starting on 30th of April, and is holding out the possibility of joint strikes if the disputes drag on, as a means of pushing the government into action. Pat Cullen, the General Secretary of the Royal College of Nursing, RCN, whose members narrowly rejected what was billed as a final pay offer by the government last week, said on Sunday there were no plans to coordinate strikes with junior doctors. While Pat Cullen recommended that the Royal College of Nursing members accept the offer of a 5% pay rise this year and a cash payment for last year, the decision of RCN members to reject it by 54% to 46% means there will be a ballot on further strikes. And if that ballot is successful, it will mean further strike action right up until Christmas, Pat Cullen told the BBC. The formal government reaction, outlined by the Conservative Party chairman Greg Hands on Sunday, is to await ballots on the pay offer from two other health unions, Unite and the GMB. However, Number 10 Downing Street appears ready to take a tough line on that. Number 10 Downing Street sources said that while the Royal College of Nursing members rejected the pay deal only narrowly, members of Unison, which represent the greatest number of NHS staff, supported the government pay offer by a margin of 74% to 26%. A letter to Pat Cullen from Health Secretary Steve Barclay, sent on Sunday and later tweeted by the Health Secretary, showed no signs of movement from the government side, offering new talks but calling the rejected pay offer a fair and reasonable settlement. The stance towards junior doctors who ended their 96-hour strike on Saturday morning appears even more uncompromising, with one government source saying ministers could not even begin an adult conversation with the British Medical Association unless it reduced its 35% pay demand and called off any further strike action. The British Medical Association says it has no contact with the government since it asked the Industrial Relations Conciliation Service, ACAS, last week to try to help find a compromise. National Health Service leaders have expressed grave worries about the possibility of a joint strike, as well as the Royal College of Nursing's proposal to escalate action, meaning areas such as accident and emergency and cancer care would not be excluded from new strikes. It's very difficult to see how either of those things wouldn't endanger patient safety and patient dignity, Matthew Taylor, the chief executive of the NHS Confederation, the membership body for the health service across the United Kingdom, told Sky News' Sophie Ridge on Sunday show. And when we're talking about the